April 24th, 2007 will come to order. I want to let you know first, we have a busy meeting today, but we need to do additional amendments on House Bill 3048, so the work session for that bill will not be held today. We'll reschedule. We have several public hearings, and I think that what I'd like to do is start with the public hearing on House Bill 3051, which we will open now. And Steve?
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 31 grants school districts new local option tax authority subject to 3051 grants school districts new local option tax authority subject to voter approval. It would allow school districts to impose taxes on personal income, corporate income, sales privilege, gross receipts, or any other tax base the district chooses. It excludes the new local option taxes from school local revenue used in the school equalization formula, and it excludes property taxes specifically from the new provisions. And most of the bill, after the first two pages, is to change the phrase local option tax in existing statutes to local option property tax to clarify the difference. It specifies procedures for a school district to submit a local option tax to its voters, and it would require the Department of Revenue to assist in the collection if it was asked to do so by a school district. And it would take effect on the 91st day after signing it.
Thank you very much. We'll hear from David Williams. Is he here? Check in the hall, would you? You're up. You asked to be called before 2 o'clock. It's before 2 o'clock.
My apologies. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association. And happy to come provide testimony in support of House Bill 3051 that you have before you today. You've had some interesting discussions in this committee about school funding, about the funding formula, and about the way we distribute dollars out to local districts. And this last interim, my legislative policy committee had a very interesting discussion about in the absence of fully funding the quality education model, which of course we would fully welcome by this body or your counterparts down at the end of the hall, that the Oregon School Boards Association would advocate for methods by which we can bring more dollars into the education system in the state, even if it is done strictly on a local level. And we think House Bill 3051 is a really fabulous way to give districts added tools that they currently don't have to ask their voters for support and for their voters to step up to the plate and support their local districts through these sort of varied taxing sources, income tax, sales tax, the dreaded words. But again, strictly the local authority for districts to step up to the plate and their voters to request for support for their schools. And we appreciate that you're hearing the bill, and hopefully we can work on it and maybe get some action on the bill.
Thank you very much. Questions? This bill, as I understand it, does nothing except give school districts the authority to ask their local taxpayers for help. Is that right?
As I understand it, that is correct.
Thank you.
That this is strictly a local option, does not raise any individual tax by the passage of this bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 3051? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3051. I've got to get back to my agenda, wherever I hit it.
You have a hidden agenda.
I have a hidden agenda. There it is. No longer hidden. Which bill have we queued up the video for?
House 2422.
And there are a lot of people here on that bill, I think, aren't there?
Yeah.
Let's open the public hearing on House Bill 2422. At Masson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2422 combines primarily two of my areas, cigarette tax and transportation. 2422A, as it comes to you from House Transportation, and 2422 proposes an increase on cigarette tax of 1 mil per cigarette. That translates to about 2 cents per pack, and those 2 cents are dedicated to elderly and disabled transportation. The process by which those amounts of money go through ODOT, from Department of Revenue through ODOT, from ODOT to the counties for their elderly and handicapped transportation program. The current law has certain amounts of money going to these transit programs at about 1.933% of current taxes. That amounts to about 2.28 cents. In the process of working this bill, Mr. Chair, I worked with the Senate, House Transportation Committee, and we took the extra step and the amendments to allow for the other programs that benefit from cigarette taxation, such as cities, counties, tobacco reduction, health plan, and the other fund, to get a compensation of the amounts that they would be losing as a result of increasing the tax. So that's why in the bill you have different percentages in Section 3 going to those other uses of the taxation system.
So this is based then on the same analysis that you made on the other cigarette tax bill that we saw, that this may have some effect on consumption, and therefore we need to modify those other numbers a little bit.
That's correct.
Thank you. Other questions for Madison? Thank you. Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Transit Association. We welcome this opportunity. We understand you're under time constraints. We have a panel of about six of us. We want to be brief, but we also want you to understand how vitally important this measure is. The transportation of the elderly and handicapped is a solely designed program by the Oregon legislature in the mid-1980s. Senator Rod Monroe, who was in the House at the time, helped start this program, and it dedicates currently 2 cents of cigarette tax, slightly more than that because of the adjustment, to the transportation of the elderly and handicapped. This is a program that is statewide. If you live in the metropolitan area, you see some TriMet vehicles and other private vehicles transporting the elderly and handicapped. If you live in rural areas, you may see taxi cabs doing this. It is in all 36 counties. It's hugely important and very successful. We have a film we'd like to show you that probably illustrates it better than me talking, so if you will bear with me, we'll start the DVD and you can watch.
How long is the film?
It's about 8 minutes.
Great, thank you.
Mr. Chair. We can turn the lights out.
It's Wednesday morning in the Eastern Oregon community of Halfway.
Good morning. How are you today?
Where do we need to go today?
And Dave Myhill is the most popular guy in town.
D and B.
Dave is a part-time driver for Community Connection of Baker County. On Wednesdays, he transports riders on what the locals call the senior bus. It's 50 miles from Halfway to Baker City. Another 50 miles back. And each leg of the journey is an adventure.
In eastern Oregon especially, it's a long ways between communities, and in the wintertime, it's an exceptionally long ways between communities. And so that one day a week they get on the bus to come to Baker is the epitome or the zenith of their life for that week.
Baker County has for many years been one of the higher percentages of seniors in population. Right now, we're looking at about 24% of those over 60, and I think we're about 19% and have been about that for people over 65.
Most of these individuals are senior citizens, and some of them are in their 90s. We try to make it comfortable for them, relaxed atmosphere for them, so they're not worried and they're not concerned about if they're going to make it to their appointment on time or if they're going to be left or how long they have to wait.
Hello, I'm We live 10 years old. I use the bus most of the time when I'm coming out to Baker. Mostly doctor's appointments. I have had recently doctor's appointments with my eyes, and I am gradually getting macular degeneration in my right eye, which I feel if it gets too much worse, I won't be able to drive.
In the state of Oregon, we know that we have roughly a half a million people over the age of 65. And roughly 25% of those folks can't drive. We know as we look out 20 years, that number will double. There are folks with physical disabilities, vision impairments. They can't drive. So public transit, that's the way they'll be able to get to the grocery store, to the doctor's appointment, to their worship places, to their jobs. That's very important for those citizens.
Ready to go, Dave?
Yeah, we're ready to head out.
Curry County is another area where distances between communities are long and critical services few and far between. So residents living along Highway 101 rely on the Coastal Express, which travels 110 miles from North Bend to Brookings four times a day.
Good morning.
74-year-old Bill Dooley is a regular on the Port Orford to Brookings leg.
I commute about 64 miles each way each day that I work down here, and I work down here 5 days a week in most instances. What have we found out on that 22 unit?
Bill manages Curry Public Transit, which consists of the InterCity Coastal Express and in-town on-demand vehicles. Both services run 6 days a week, and according to Bill, demand is high.
We are almost 50% population over 60 at the present time in the Brookings Harbor area. The total in the county, I have been told, runs up between 35 and 40% population over the age of 60.
See you in a little while. I rely on the dollar ride. They take me out to the beauty shop, then I call 2:30 to go home. And everybody knows that I ride it, so if I'm 5 minutes late or 10 minutes early, it's fine.
You got Bill, right?
I did get Bill, yes.
Our service allows them to continue to be independent far longer than they would be able to be if we were not in existence in the area. It's vitally important that these people be able to hang on, so to speak, to that independence as long as they can.
Wayne, this is exciting.
For Bob Bergman of Eugene, independence means the ability to get to work on time.
Bob is a pretty miraculous young man for the difficulties that he has, I think. He's now 55 years old, so we have gone through 55 years of dealing with differences. Because he was a preemie, he had the cerebral palsy. And did take him in for physicals, of course, and was referred to an ophthalmologist. And I suppose that that was a very landmark day, the day that I was told he was blind. Hard.
Today, Bob works at Oregon Research Institute. It's a job he loves and a job that benefits his community.
We've seen a transformation of Bob that's just been unbelievable. He likes to have fun. He likes to do a lot of things. And the Lane Transit District's opportunity of riding the bus has allowed him to do that.
We want them, and they want to be meaningful and productive members of society. We know that public transportation, or the lack thereof, is a great barrier to getting people to work. Thus, it's a challenge to acquire a meaningful employment.
If I didn't have the city bus, I'd be stuck at home.
Doing what?
Just playing with my CB radios.
It's all a big pie where you cut it into, you know, living, working, and social. And it takes transportation to do every single one of them.
I think that you'll realize very quickly the number of people in your family probably need some kind of assistance. And where family members or friends are unable to provide that service, that's where the Public Transit Division and our program step up to try to fill that void.
The main source of funds that's available for community transportation services are federal funds, which we can flex out of the highway appropriations, and those funds primarily are used for equipment acquisitions. We flex as much as we can. We work with the local districts to maximize our ability to stretch those funds as far as possible, but we never have enough.
It's more than tires, gasoline, or vehicle. It's a social support system that is just critical.
It just opens doors that we never would have imagined. And if we can make that happen for folks, all folks, not just folks with disabilities, then it will be a much better community.
It's good stuff.
Thank you for your indulgence in saying that. I think it really illustrates the three commissioners point out, or Stuart Foster and Mike Nelson point out the need for it. I think Matt Garrett spelled it out very well. The federal government gives us the capital through various flexible funds. The dollars that we need to operate it come from both the cigarette tax and the ID cards that are issued by DMV to people who don't buy driver license but buy the ID cards. The program has been immensely effective and popular, and it's growing, and we've simply run out of the capital to make this happen. In Rogue Valley, for instance, the Rogue Valley Transportation District has had to cut back the entire route that went to the local hospital just because they simply don't have the funds to do it. We desperately need the increase that's contained in this bill. We fully realize that there's a somewhat sideswipe collision going on with the governor's medical program for juveniles. We don't want to stand in the way, but we do not want you to overlook this issue. We feel very strongly you need to pass this bill this session. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me have the others come up.
Thank you. Please do. You go ahead and call them.
Yeah. Chair Barnhart, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Julie Wilkie, and I'm the mobility manager at Ride Connection in Portland, Oregon. Transportation for our older adults and people with disabilities is as large a social issue as housing and food. The need for transportation crosses all ages and socioeconomic.
Ms. Wilkie, you have provided testimony in writing, and we really appreciate that. And it looks to me as though you're reading it. What I would really prefer is if you could summarize your key points so we can make certain that we get all of our work done today. And I'll ask the committee members to be sure to read the rest of what you have given us.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barnhart, thank you very much. Sorry about that. I came in at the last minute. The three points that I really wanted to make today were that really is that we are doing everything to be as efficient as possible, that our customers' transportation needs are really growing faster than our capacity to serve them, and that also the House Bill that we're asking for today is critical in order for us to continue with our transportation services that we're providing in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. As you know, we have, our population is growing. Over 8,000 people are turning the age of 60, or turning 60 years of age every day. And one of the stories, I just want to talk about actually the people that we're serving and how this is affecting their quality of life and their independence. I started as a volunteer driver many years ago, and I have met so many people along the way that have really benefited. It's enhanced their quality of life as well as it's kept them independent in their own home. I'm thinking about Agnes, who was 85 years old. She was a widow and had outlived her husband's retirement. She had macular degeneration and was no longer able to get around on her own, but was committed to staying in her own home. And we were able to provide her transportation to her medical appointments, and also she was on our grocery shopping shuttle on a weekly basis. And I remember one of the things is that she wasn't able to afford taxi service to these critically important needs. But she always had a bowl of raspberries for the driver, because she grew raspberries in her garden, and that she felt that that was the way that she was contributing back. I wanted to share another story about Seth, who is 20 years old. He has gotten his first job at the airport, and he really wants to be an independent traveler, but needs to learn how to ride the public bus system. And one of the services that we provide is for travel training. So Seth has autism, and he really wants to be independent. With our travel trainer spending just a couple of weeks teaching him how to ride public transportation, he is now completely independent, and that's some of these services that are really provided by this much-needed funding. We're really doing as much as we can with the funds that we have. We're trying to be as efficient as possible. We look at the person's individual ability level and determine what best meets not only their ability but their need. And so we're definitely looking at the types of services and trying to be the most cost effective as we can. We ask for your support on this bill. It will really allow us and others like us around the state to serve a growing number of older adults. Just in our last 6 months, we have had a 8% turndown rate. That means that really, and we see that with census data, that this number will only increase unless something is done. So we ask for your support on House Bill 2422, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. And if you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Whoever's next.
I'll go ahead. Hi, my name is Andy Vibora. I'm the Director of Service Planning, Accessibility, and Marketing at Lane Transit District in Lane County. And we, too, urge the passage of 2422. And I've provided written testimony for you to review as well. Let me just pull out a couple of highlights for you that I think are really important. As Julie said, efficiency. I think every provider around the state is working very hard to do paratransit as efficiently as possible. And there's a lot of innovative ways that have been done, and some of those are outlined in the written testimony, but I think that's a real important point, that folks are working hard on efficiency. The growth rate, because of the aging population, because people who become aware of these services realize they can use it more often, drives the demand. And we're seeing it in the same or greater numbers than what Julie talked about. And because this service is mandated through the ADA, we can't not do it. We can do some things such as, you know, restrict the boundaries by changing our fixed route service boundaries to change how and where we provide paratransit service, but that's not a good solution, because the demand is out there and people deserve this kind of service. So we're faced with the dilemma of backfilling what's not covered through this tobacco tax with our general fund. And I think that's a major issue in a big sense for all public transportation, because those are dollars that go into providing public transportation to the larger community. And the more effective we can be with fixed route transit service, the better off our communities are going to be. But while we have to trade these dollars around and backfill what's not being generated through other tax or funding sources, then the community loses out. And we want to be able to serve the greater community. Our demand for fixed route is growing. Our ridership is growing. And it's a real sad situation when we're going to have to look at actually cutting fixed route service to provide this mandated service. And we'll do it because it's important and it is mandated. But I think that we need to figure out a way to fully fund this type of service. And this doesn't do it, but it gets us closer and it helps us to maintain those fixed route services that serve the rest of our community. So I really do encourage you to work hard, get this bill passed, and help us to provide these necessary services. Thank you.
Thank you. Ed?
Are there any questions for Andy?
There probably will be. Why don't you go ahead and we'll get to those in a minute.
Well, my written testimony is pretty complete. Representative Reed, don't I remember you from Terry Byers from Representative Byers?
And Vice Chair Butler as well. Good member.
I'm, you know, the issue here, the whole issue that this bill addresses in a roundabout way is quality of life. When I was living in a residential care facility, my mother contracted or developed or whatever, Lou Gehrig's disease. And I used RideSource, which is the LTD affiliated paratransit service, to go home a couple of days a week so that my father could go to the doctor, shop, and so forth. Now, my injury was pretty severe. I was paralyzed on one side, couldn't speak, eat, anything. But I had reached a point. I was and am one of the very fortunate ones. I reached a point where he trusted me to take care of my mother. And one time, she had lost control of the muscles in her neck, and her head just kind of went to the side. One time, I developed a strap that was held by Velcro onto the chair, the wheelchair, to hold her head up straight and gave her a little bit more dignity. When I did that, I realized that I could help people. It didn't always have to be someone caring for me. When I received a letter in the mail asking RideSource users how they used the service and what it meant to them, I answered. I told them the story of my mother and father. The accessible services manager was so impressed that she asked me to come to at that time it was STF, Special Transportation Fund meeting. This was 10 years ago. It didn't take me long to realize that need was increasing and funding was decreasing. I asked if there was some way I could help and asked if I could volunteer at the RideSource facility. I could obviously say I couldn't drive, but I worked in as a call taker. And it changed my life. The committee led to other committees, board, and so forth. The volunteer work led to other volunteer work. At that time, a full day was 300 rides. 300. And the last I heard, they were over 500. I'm one of the very fortunate ones. I really am. But I only came this far because paratransit, because transportation was available to me when I needed it. Need is still increasing. It's time for funding to increase a little bit. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Ed. Yes, please. Are there questions for this panel? I have a couple. And it may be for the two on the ends, although, Ed, if you have an answer, please. You run essentially two different systems. One is the fixed route system, and the other is the system that we're talking about today. I'm assuming that a fair number of the people who might qualify are also using the fixed route system, in addition to Ed. He's not the only one.
There are an entire group of riders that are called conditional riders that are eligible, are partially eligible for the paratransit system. So they, and in some trips, they can take the bus. Some trips, they can't take the bus. That is $20 a trip on the paratransit. So there is, there are those that use both.
Thank you.
Yes, and in Portland, Ride Connection is a nonprofit, and actually we complement that paratransit service. So we have fixed route, our ADA service, and then the complementary service. We have a one-number call system where we're matching, again, people with their ability level on what service works best for them. So we're really, and our rides at Ride Connection last fiscal year, I believe it was $11.29 for a one-way trip. So it's cheaper than the ADA service, and we always try and steer people to the fixed route system that have the ability to ride the system.
And all of your systems have ways of getting access to the bus for people in wheelchairs, a variety of ways of getting on the bus. Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say in my written testimony, there's a couple of programs highlighted to really work with people with disabilities to help them to use the fixed route service. And that's so important, one, from a cost side, but also from an independence side for people who have those disabilities to be able to ride whenever they want to when the bus is operating rather than to schedule a trip 24 hours in advance and the more limited transportation through paratransit. So it's called Transit Host Program. It's been very effective. It's being emulated or copied around the country now.
Thank you very much. Other questions for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your coming, Ed. Thanks for coming up. It's always great to see you.
Thank you, Representative Beinhart. It's always good to see you, too.
Does that mean a conflict of interest there? I mean, a good constituent. My constituent comes in on the movie. Ed comes and visits his representative.
That's right.
Well, I'm not exactly his constituent, but I keep moving over into his.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Catherine, is it White? And I have another. Where is it? Juliet Parrott.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
While they're coming up, can I ask a question,
please.
Staff? Mazin, when these projections were done, which showed this increase we're talking about, raising an additional $6.7 million in revenue, did that take into consideration the tax bill that we're voting this week, the 85 cents per pack, or not? Does your projection assume that larger cigarette tax passes, or does it not assume that? And the reason I ask the question is because when you made your presentation on that larger tax, we showed a pretty significant decline in cigarette sales. And so I'm going to guess that would significantly affect the revenue estimates with this smaller tax proposal.
Yes, Representative Bruin, I think the way we've done the estimates is independent of House Bill 2201. Now, interestingly, Legislative Council at the end of each session does conflict amendments and conflict resolutions and so on. I think if these two bills pass, we would have to do something similar to that at the end of the session.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm here on behalf of the Developmental Disabilities Coalition, which is an organization, coalition of about 26 members that represent people with developmental disabilities, providers, families, and others. And I have submitted written testimony, so I'll keep my comments very brief. I've included, in addition to my testimony, some testimony from Self-Advocates as Leaders, which is a self-advocacy organization, and just some personal letters. When we do any kind of surveys of issues among people with developmental disabilities, the number one issue that they mention is the lack of transportation. And their inability to participate in social activities, the barrier it presents to employment, It is the key issue for them, and frankly, I can't possibly convey the sense of emotion around this issue that many people share with us, because it is, as everyone has mentioned previously and the film showed, it is about quality of life. It is about participating in community, and as we have strongly pushed for people with disabilities to be active members of our community, the one key that is there is the issue of transportation. While more transportation occurs in the urban areas, it's often difficult for people to access. It is truly an isolating factor for individuals with disabilities who live in rural areas. And it is that key to keeping people involved and engaged. And as a person, you know, we live in an auto culture. We build our communities around automobiles and transportation. And as an individual who is dealing with both taking her her keys away from her 95-year-old mother, which many people will tell you is one of the more difficult and challenging interactions one can have with an aging parent. And as the parent of a 28-year-old son with autism, I see the need for this kind of transportation availability, both within the senior and the disabled community. This is critical to the quality of life in Oregon. We recognize as a coalition the challenges that you're facing around the cigarette tax, and we are very supportive of the utilization for the cigarette tax. We feel it is important part of the discussions on health care. We also feel that this is a very critical issue to the health and the well-being of Oregon and the quality of life of Oregonians who are seniors and people with disabilities. And we urge you to increase the cigarette tax, this small amount, to address this critical issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Parrott?
Well, hello, everyone. My name is Juliet Parrott, and I'm here today as an STFAC member and also a citizen. And I just want to give you a little bit of background about my life. I was born with cerebral palsy, and I'm going to be 35 this year. And I grew up out in Boring, Oregon. And is this microphone? Can everyone hear me?
Oh, it's working fine.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
All right. Sorry. So I grew up out in Boring. My parents moved out there when I was 6. And I don't know if any of you guys have ever had the privilege of going to Boring. When I lived out there, it was all farmland. It was there was just nothing out there, especially for, kids with disabilities that wanted to do anything. If I wanted to do anything, I had to depend on others. I had to depend on my parents. I had to depend on friends, and everyone was busy. So as a consequence of that, I spent a lot of time alone. On a big farm with lots to do, but I still spent a lot of time alone, and I was isolated because I really didn't have any friends. My nearest friend was like a quarter mile up the road, and I missed out on a lot of opportunities that were easier for my able-bodied friends to access than me. And I want you guys to know I went to school in Portland, so I was bused into school every day from Boring, and I would see the buses on the road, and I would see the city life, and I dreamed about that every single day. I said to myself, when I get older, because the buses weren't accessible yet, I said, when I get older, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to ride the bus. I'm going to ride the bus. And I dreamed about that hard every single day. And so when I was just before my 22nd birthday, I dropped the bombshell on my folks and I said, Mom and Dad, I think I'm ready to move out. And my parents had always teased me. Like my dad would stand in the doorway of my room and he'd say, when you move out, I'm going to turn your room into an office and this and that. And so finally I really did drop the bombshell and I said, I'm really moving out, Mom and Dad. And he said, well, are you sure you can do it? Are you sure? Are you sure? Have you thought it all through? And I said, yes, I want to move out. So I moved into Gresham, where it was about 7 or maybe even 8 or 9 miles from home, but I had access to the buses, and I had access to the light rail, and I could just walk up, you know, just walk up the street and get on the MAX and go anywhere in Portland. And I was so excited. I was so excited. What I would do every day is I would get on the MAX and I would say, oh, there's some store, something I wanted to see in some place. So I would get off and I would go exploring around that area, you know. And that's how I learned my way around. I did not have programs like RideWise to help me with any kind of travel training. I had to do it all by myself. I just had to be observant, and I had to, because I was going to college at that time, I was going to Mount Hood Community College, and my mother had to take me to and from school. Every day, my mom would make 2 trips in just so that I could go to college, which I think is pretty extraordinary. But anyway, so I would watch my friends at college, and I would listen to them talk about how they went here and how they went there on the bus, and I would say, I'm going to do that someday. And I did, and one day I got on the bus, and I went to the Gresham Fred Meyers, and I called my mom. She was supposed to pick me up from school that day, and I said, Mama, guess where I am? And she said, you're at school, because I dropped you off there. And I said, no, I'm not. And she said, where are you? And I said, I'm at the Gresham Fred Meyers. And she said, how did you get there? And I said, I took the bus. And I was so excited. And so from that day on, I was taking the bus. And my mom and I, you know, because I was still living at home a little bit. But my mom and I, we made an agreement that I would always call to let her know that I made it to wherever I was going to. And so that just totally opened up my life. I was able to explore Portland and the outlying areas, which I'd always wanted to do, because I'd always heard about that on TV, and I'd always, you know, seen things. So I wanted to do that. I got to see that. I got to get a job. I've just gotten to live my life, and it's totally opened up things for me. Without these services, I wouldn't have been able to do. And I'm so fortunate. And the reason I'm here testifying before you today is because of special transportation services. So the opportunities and the successes I've had in my life because of transportation is the reason that I urge you to support this bill, because I want other people with disabilities to have the same opportunities as well.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank you for your excellent testimony and for demonstrating both on this issue and so many others that the things that those of us that don't have disabilities sometimes take for granted, it's those simple things that give people with disabilities the opportunity to be independent, to work, to make money, to have their own homes, and to pursue opportunities that everyone should be able to pursue. And you've been a great spokesperson for that today. So thank you.
Thank you
for coming and speaking so eloquently.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions or comments? Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure whether this is directed at Roger Martin or Catherine White. Both of them are kind of go-to people on these kinds of questions. Two questions. Number one, there is a request before the Transportation Committee to reduce the fares for some seniors. That would increase the overall needs. So my question here is, will the amount that fiscal or revenue is showing us, would that be sufficient? And the second question that I had was, this I'm assuming would have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, because we need to address the total needs of the transit and developmentally disabled transit. So I just need to make sure that relative to the
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Roger Martin again. No, the bill that you spoke about in the committee that would reduce the senior fare by somewhere between $150 and $200 million, or $200,000, will just cause us a further shortage because it will add to the requirement of this program. And this program in itself, even if you fund it, is still going to leave us short in some communities. But it's vitally necessary that we get somewhere, and I guess it should go to Ways and Means. I don't know if it has a previous referral, but the Ways and Means Transportation Committee is considering these kind of subjects right now.
This bill has had an interesting course. It started in this committee. It was referred to transportation. It came back to us. While it does not have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, I suspect that is probably what we should do with it if we pass it out of this committee. I had a couple of other questions if other people don't. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I may have been out of the room when this was discussed, but I was just curious how widely available this transportation option is in rural Oregon.
All 36 counties. Part of the film that you weren't able to see shows far eastern Oregon, represent Butler's district and the southern Oregon coast, but all of Columbia, Clatsop, all the counties in the state have these services.
Thank you.
And I'm not sure this is a question for you. It may be a question for those who are actually working with the transit districts. Well, I'm curious as to what percentage of the current budgets are being backfilled from other funds. Fares or from payroll taxes or other sources of funds, and maybe you could come forward and answer that question. To get an idea of how much we're actually spending from things that are designed for other purposes.
Chair Barnhart, committee members. At Lane Transit District, we receive about $636,000 this year from the tobacco tax. We are backfilling that in the current budget with $1.5 million of general fund, and we're coming up about $300,000 short on that $1.5 million, so we'll spend about $1.8 million out of general fund dollars by June 30th of this year. And again, we're estimating 10% increase in that for next year, which we think at the staff level is a little bit low, but that's the impact for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy, that 10%, is that made up of costs of the higher fuel prices? Is that a combination of everything? And then how would the proposed reduction in fares for seniors affect Lane Transit?
It's a combination of things. Certainly fuel prices have leveled off. We saw a big hit a couple of years ago. Those have leveled off a little bit. What we're seeing is two things. Some new applicants and members who are taking advantage of the service, which drives up demand, and also longer trip times and longer times associated with the type of trips. Medical trips require some additional wait time as people don't know when they're going to get out of the doctor sometimes, so costs a little bit more for those types of trips. So it's a combination of things. And now I forgot your second part of your question.
That's your question. I was just
That's fine. That answers that. The other part of that I didn't ask was the aging of the population.
Oh, on the senior fare.
Right.
Oh, for us. The change from a 50% reduction in the adult fare down to the senior fare down to the proposed 20% number that's being batted around won't have a big impact on us. LTD, we currently start our senior fares at age 62. It's mandated through FTA at age 65. But we only charge seniors from age 62 to 69. Currently, we have a program at age 70. All of our seniors ride free. So we're talking about a marginal loss from that group.
Thank you.
That's not the same throughout the state.
Thank you. Other large transit districts have similar kinds of cost problems, I mean cost issues? I suspect that they do.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Bruno.
Could I ask one more question of
Please.
Mr. Martin? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Roger. My question is the same question I had for staff. Has your group projected what will happen to your revenue with the passage of the larger cigarette tax, almost regardless whether or not your tax bill passes or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, no, we haven't. We don't have the ability that you have with staff people, so we haven't done that.
Anson, did you want to respond to that one?
Mr. Chair, if this bill passes passes through here, and then we're looking at two bills increasing the cigarette tax. Now, there's some positives and negatives, I guess. Both bills have floor tax, and the process of floor tax would allow, for example, savings in that you have to impose it only once rather twice. And then you would increase the amount on top, and those, if we are looking to re-examine and readjust the amounts of revenues that would be lost from the different programs, we would have probably go through another run. Either we do an adjustment of some sort, or that could be left for the next session of sorts.
Well, and I think the specific question, if I may, was if we pass the other bill, does that affect the funds that are already coming into this program as a result of the decrease in probable sales? And I think I know the answer to that. Representative Bruce?
Well, I guess I try to make the point that if we pass that larger bill based on all the modeling we've seen, there's going to be a decrease in cigarette sales in the state to some degree or the other. I think that's the popular consensus. And so I guess my point is a question, are they asking for enough? If that passes, are they asking for enough, Mr. Chair, Mr. Martin? And that's a rhetorical question more than a specific question.
I suppose not, but given the political atmosphere, we'd be satisfied if we can get this.
Right now, if Lane Transit District is right about the statewide numbers, they're paying three-quarters of the cost out of their other funds already. And so anything that we any increase we gave them would decrease their other funds' costs.
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, this is for staff, but did we not amend 2201 to adjust back for counties, cities, and local transit districts? I think we did so as to accommodate that. If this were to pass, then you've got an additional hydraulic effect that would happen in that process. So
2201, okay. That's good to
2201
know.
2201 did have a hydraulic in it to accommodate
the
cities, counties, and special districts, but then this will create an additional hydraulic, and I'm not sure what the N minus 0.0 whatever factor we've got here. It would be very small on this two mills, or the one mill, as
everything. That's a great point.
Thank you. Representative Byer.
Thank you. For the record, Representative Terry Byer from House District 12, and sorry I'm late, and I'm sure they covered everything you needed to know about this bill. I just want to stress that this it's a pretty important program that we have. It definitely isn't a one-size-fits-all. It's different all around the state. But that doesn't change the need. The need can be greater, obviously, in areas where there isn't as much. I think we need to just remember that our senior population is growing pretty rapidly, and our system has actually lost money. And I think in I have to go back to my other notes. I think that the allocation for the counties in 2007-2008 is 10% less than they got in 2006 and 2007. So we aren't actually even remaining level at this point. We're losing ground, plus the need is growing. So I'd just like you to remember that this is a very valuable service. It is the only way some people can actually get around and get to important places that they need to be. And I certainly would urge you to pass this bill.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Other than a potential taxing opportunity here. I'm wondering if there's any particular nexus for cigarettes, or whether it's time for us to consider taxing things like coffee and whatnot. I have to say that at some point the diminishing returns that Representative Bruin has already described here may beg for other sources of revenue.
And thank you, Representative Witt. I think you're probably right, that, but it's just been really difficult to find any type of a revenue that is stable and is always there. The problem is there are a lot of these funding sources are one-time funding sources, and to get something that's ongoing can be challenging. We did, in 03, actually, we did dedicate a good portion of the ID fee, ODOT's fees for their ID cards, and dedicated that to this transportation system. So we have been looking, and we have made some changes, but even now we're looking at bills this session that want to eat into to that funding, because there just isn't much money in the highway systems that isn't dedicated to the highway. And so there we are, the same as with Connect Oregon. You're really, it's challenging looking for funding for other transportation systems.
Certainly. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Beyer, for your dedication and your work on this. You've indicated that the senior population is rapidly growing, that we are losing ground at the rate of about 10% per biennium. Is that losing ground, is that in terms of the collections of tobacco taxes that come into this program?
You know, I couldn't tell you exactly where all these pieces are coming from, but I was told by one of the districts that they were just recently notified that their allocation was 10% less, and that was out of all the funding sources. So I don't know whether it's money that we're not collecting in the lawnmower fund, which is where part of this is, whether it's a decrease in the cigarette tax. I think it's really more a combination of all those funding sources.
Thank you.
Mazin, did you want to respond to that question?
Mr. Chair, the amount, I think the 10% is a combination of increasing population, elderly population, therefore higher demand for amounts, then inflation, plus this. And
are the ID cards part of that too? Then is it
the ID cards and the what's known as the lawnmower funds? Or
right. I contribute heavily to that.
The lawnmower fund,
yes. And the lawnmower fund for information is the gas tax that is not dedicated to the highway fund that moves lawnmowers and leaf blowers and that kind of thing.
And for which no refund is claimed. Huh?
That's no refund claimed.
Yeah.
And Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, at the risk of offending anybody, we did discover that we are actually collecting for ATVs for the parks, and that money actually is going into the highway fund, and it is a non-highway use. So there is money there that maybe needs to be diverted back to where it should go.
We would certainly love the assistance of the Transportation Committee to pursue that. Any port in a storm, as it were. Other questions for Representative Beyer? Thank you very
Thank
much
you very and,
for appearing today. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 2422? Seeing no one, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2422. And are the Dash 3s ready on House Bill 3047? Are those here? They are. All right. Let's open our work session on House Bill 3047. Mm-hmm. And we have the dash one amendments, but I don't think we have the dash three.
Oh, they're coming.
Oh, okay. Here they come.
The dash two was replaced by the dash three.
Okay.
There isn't a dash three.
Now, is the dash one separate from?
Yes, it is. And both have to be amended.
Both have to be amended into the bill. Would you like to cover the bill for us again quickly, and
certainly.
Let's see if we can act on it.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3047 creates a county road fund in which property taxes for roads derived from local option taxes shall be deposited for apportionment. It allows a county, road districts, and incorporated cities located within the county to modify the apportionment formula by agreement. The remainder of the bill really clarifies the law with the amendments. The first dash one amendment, for example, will correct an unintended repeal of the county's discretionary authority to use funds in its treasury as an emergency arises that requires immediate action, and the money provided in the county road fund has already been expended. The dash three amendment, which replaces the dash two, clarifies basically existing law, but again, the proponents of the bill really wanted this clarified. It clarifies that no ad valorem tax may be expended on any roads or bridges except for funds derived from a levy within the permanent rate limit of Section 11 of the Constitution. If voter-approved county serial levies were dedicated to road improvements, if a voter-approved county serial levy dedicated to road improvements was used in determining the permanent rate limit for that jurisdiction, clarifies that the apportionment of the road taxes, including local option property taxes, is subject to Oregon's constitutional limitations, that is, property possible compression. And that pretty much is done already, but it's clarification.
Right, and this takes care of a couple of counties that had problems with this issue.
Okay.
If I recall. Yes. All right. What's your pleasure? Is this bill ready to? This bill is ready to move, is it not? If we put the dash ones and the dash threes.
Mr. Chair, are we in work session?
Yes, we are.
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash one amendment to House Bill 3047, dated March the 20th, 07, be appended to House Bill 3047.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 3047. Discussion? Is there objection to the dash ones? Seeing none, the dash ones are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendments to House Bill 3047, dated 4/16/07, be appended to House Bill 3047 as amended with the dash ones.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves the dash three amendment. Discussion? Is there objection to the dash threes? Seeing none, dash threes are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3047 to the floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves House Bill 3047 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Aye.
Representative Brennan.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Yes.
Representative Butler.
Aye.
Yes.
Representative
Reed. Aye.
Representative
Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative
Smith. Aye. The bill received a unanimous vote. Is there any reason why this should not be placed on a consent agenda?
Actually, I think that we should probably talk about this on the floor.
Okay. Who would like to carry it?
I don't have a problem with it.
Representative Olson?
Sure.
Thank you. Representative Olson will carry the bill. Bill has passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 3047. Thank you. Next bill, public hearing on House Bill 3455.
Mm-hmm.
We'll open a public hearing on that bill, 3455.
Mary? Thank you, Mr. Chair. 3455 revises the definition of an urban renewal plan's consolidated billing rate to include urban renewal plans that have been substantially amended. Specifically, if an urban renewal plan is a reduced rate plan before it is substantially amended, it remains a reduced plan after it has been substantially amended. Takes effect upon becoming law. Apparently, during the 2001 session, legislation was enacted that provided that some urban renewal plans adopted after 2001 would no longer benefit
would no longer have to divide their local option taxes between urban renewal areas and the remaining jurisdictions. Division of tax, it's called. These urban renewal plans are referred to now as reduced rate plans, and the other plans continue to apply division of tax to their local option taxes, and they're referred to as standard rate plans. Apparently a glitch in the legislation, or apparently it's... We're not sure about what the legislative intent was, but when the legislation was enacted, possible changes in ORS 457 were not considered. As a consequence, after an urban renewal reduced rate plan is substantially amended, it reverts to being a standard rate plan, which means it has to go through division of tax when it has new local option taxes that are approved. Okay.
It makes sense so far.
Marginally.
As seen as Squires, and anybody you'd like to bring with you from the list?
Bring them up.
Take a number. There's another chair sort of pushed over to the side over here.
Bodyguards. Someone news.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hasina Squires. I'm here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. First of all, would like to extend my thanks to Representative Butler from Ontario, who introduced this piece of legislation at our request for our Kaiser Rural Fire Protection District, but we believe that the bill possibly has applicability in future years to other entities, and that's what Mr. Conkling will address. Mary gave you a very good summary. I could talk at length on urban renewal and probably make your head explode because it's mind-numbing and mind-boggling at times. I want to make a few points about what this bill, why this bill is here. House Bill 3215 in the 2001 legislative session, we believe, had some unintended consequences. What that bill said was that existing plans and new plans adopted after October 6th of 2001, those plans were no longer required to divide the new local option taxes, and those plans are now called reduced rate plans. There are a whole set of other plans that are called standard plans. Those are plans that aren't required to divide local option taxes. When a reduced rate plan is substantially amended, so there's an urban renewal agency, for instance, City of Kaiser, and they go through a substantial plan amendment under ORS 457-010 sub 4, sub 5, it stops being a reduced rate plan and it reverts to being a standard rate plan. In that instance, problems occur for districts who have local option levies that have been enacted within an urban renewal agency, and that's precisely what happened with the City of Kaiser and the Kaiser Rural Fire Protection District. In 2005, Kaiser did go through a substantial plan amendment, and their plan then changed from a reduced rate plan to a standard rate plan, and then, therefore, the Kaiser Fire District's taxes began being divided, the division of tax applied. So we believe that House Bill 3455 addresses this problem and makes the correction so these entities who have local option levies passed on within an urban renewal agency, when, again, they go through a substantial plan amendment, collect the taxes that they expected that they would collect. There is a Dash 1 amendment that you should have at your place. When we submitted it to Legislative Council, two letters were left out, and urban renewal is just that technical that if you don't have everything, your I's dotted and your T's crossed, it can cause unintended consequences. So without the Dash 1 amendment and the change that we need to the Dash 1 amendment on line 12, a large A and a large B need to be inserted into that. We believe have consensus from the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies, League of Oregon Cities, and our association on this technical change. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Ego from Kaiser Fire District.
Thank you, Sam. Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Greg Ego. I'm the current president of the Kaiser Rural for Fire Protection District Board of Directors. The Kaiser Fire District, we understand the need for urban renewal districts. The Kaiser Fire District is approximately 90% of our district is located within the boundary of the city of Kaiser. However, the use of urban renewal districts has a significant financial impact, and this fix, when the City of Kaiser did their change from their plan in 2005, had significant financial impact on the Kaiser Fire District. In the last 9 years, the City of Kaiser has had an urban renewal district, and they made their change in 2005 to take some areas out of the urban renewal district that were built out and to put some new areas in, and that extended the indebtedness and the amount of money. So that changed it from the reduced rate plan, I have that backwards, from reduced rate to standard rate. What that meant for us right away, in 2002, November, we passed a local option levy of 35 cents per thousand. We started collecting those revenues in the 2003-2004 year. But because of this glitch, when the amendment was done, in our 2006-2007 budget, we lose approximately $66,000 of our local option funds, and next year we lose about $81,000 of our local option funds, on top of the funds we're already losing to urban renewal in property taxes that we do not receive that from the incremental value.
Good question, Mr. Chair. Please, Representative Butler.
So at that point, Greg, the $66,000 is then divided proportionally amongst all other districts that are in the urban renewal district. Is that correct?
No, that's the portion that we lose that goes to urban renewal.
From the entire district goes directly to urban renewal,
right.
Not to the other district.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
And so this change, if the change goes through, it doesn't substantially drop what the renewal district would have gotten originally. It just gives our part back.
Good.
So we have that available to us. So we generate about $400,000 a year in our local option levy. Urban renewal takes about $320,000 over the average of 16 years. So we're kind of using our local option levy to backfill, if you will, what we're losing to urban renewal. So we're only getting about $80,000 net value out of our local option levy to use for expanding services, new equipment, the things that need to happen in a growing fire service. So I've given you written testimony that gives all the details and the numbers and how we've gone through this. We think that this is a good fix, a simple fix to an unintended problem. It was brought to our attention when we met with the City of Keyser as they were amending their urban renewal. In fact, we didn't even get it from the City of Keyser. We got it from the treasurer when she said, "Do you guys realize that this affects you, the 70,000? So we met with the city, and their response to us, their hands were tied because of the wording in the legislation that it had to go, as the size of the amendment they made, it had to go to a standard rate plan. And so their hands were tied. Even though they recognized the problem and the financial hardship it caused us, they still had to approve it that way because that's the only option that they had at that time. Had they had the option, I believe they would have approved it as a reduced rate plan so that we would have been left whole. So if the citizens of Keyser who voted for our local option levy understand that all that money goes to the fire district, not 18% of it are potentially going back to urban renewal. So we urge your support on this measure, 3455. Again, I appreciate Representative Butler bringing this forward for us. It is important to us. Dollars, you know, today are very important, trying to keep up the ones that you already have and trying to hang on to those. So,
Representative Berger?
Yeah, I have a question, but I think it may be of Marion. She's not there.
She's gone to get Ledge Council so that we can discover whether or not we can do this amendment.
Okay, well, my question then is, because this is very technical, is would this legislation help Keyser the way it's written? I mean, they are caught in this. I don't see anything about the dates and the implementation or anything. So my question is, as written, would it solve the problem, or would you just have to endure and it would solve the problem for the next guy down the line?
Chair Barnhart, Ripley, and Berger, I believe that we endure it. It solves the problem because I don't believe there's any retroactive this. I think we're stuck with these 2 years of missing out on the funds, but we don't want that to happen to us or other junior taxing districts in the future.
The 2 years, but going forward.
I believe it corrects the going forward, too, so that as we have additional option, if we go up for local option levy in 2008, that we would be made whole on it. We wouldn't lose anything.
Okay, and the next question is probably of Asina. She's looking the other way.
Yeah, sorry, I'm conferring with the Department of Revenue.
Yeah, and this is complicated. Do you have any idea of the universe of folks? I mean, Keyser's come forward with a, you know, absolute example. Mm-hmm. How many others are out there, do you have a sense? I mean, it's got to have a local option. I mean, there's all these little stars that have to align, but could you just look at that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I recall Mary Ayala asking Tom Linares, who is with the Multnomah County Tax Supervising Conservation Commission, he had to leave at 2 o'clock, but asking the question about how many of these possible plans could it apply to, and his answer was 37. I believe that's in his testimony, that it's potentially going to affect 37 other urban renewal plans. And we do know, and Mr. Conklin can testify to that, that it will have a large effect if we don't fix it in Multnomah County next year.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please. And were you finished?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Gary Conkling, representing Multnomah County, and I'm pinch-hitting for Mr. Lynn Harris, who I think has submitted testimony. His testimony, in addition to reiterating what you heard from staff as well as the other witnesses in describing the problem, provides an example in Multnomah County that affects a number of local options. By an amendment made by the Portland Development Commission on its Central East Side Plan. And on the second page of his testimony, you can see actually the various local options that range from a Portland Public School local option to a county library, a parks, City of Portland Park, City of Portland Children Investment local option, and Metro's open space bond measure, with GO bonds would also be affected. The net effect of losing the ability of maintaining this urban renewal area as a reduced rate area is about a $500,000 difference for these particular areas. Again, it's our understanding this is an unintended outcome, and all this bill seeks to do is essentially try to, what we think, achieve what was originally intended. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
If I could clarify, there's the potential of 37, but it only becomes an issue when there is an amendment, a major amendment to the plan. So none of these 37 would automatically be impacted. They potentially could with a major amendment. Am I correct? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that's absolutely correct. Unless an urban renewal agency went through a substantial plan amendment, they wouldn't get kicked
that's
into it.
Substantial.
Hence the point of the amendment that you've proposed, I think, too, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, I am Steve Bryant, wearing two hats today. One is as the interim legislative director for the League of Oregon Cities. The second is as staff person to the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies. We represent the urban renewal agencies, of which there are about 60 in the state of Oregon. You have a handout from me that tries to outline in as simple terms as we could put it how this very technical fix would resolve this situation. I think you've had it very well described by your staff, and at least for me, it needed repetition about four or five times before it finally sank in. So if you need me to go through any of it again, I'd be happy to do that, although I suspect you'd be comfortable to know that we support the bill with the amendments as Hasina described. You need to recognize that for some of our agencies, this would in fact represent a loss of revenue. However, the gain in revenue that we achieved was inadvertent. I don't think those agencies that elected to be reduced rate plans had any expectation that they would receive the tax increment revenues from these local option levies. It was always their intent that those local option levies go back to the taxing district for which the voters passed those levies. So this is the fix that we need with the amendments described. Hasina and I were just having a little bit of a sidebar conversation about whether or not the amendment does, in fact, retroactively correct the Kaiser situation, and I'm not sure that it does. So we may need some additional conversation about that with our friends with the City of Kaiser. I believe they are comfortable with that fix, and I think they believed it was going to have that effect. I would like the opportunity to confirm that. I do know they had some other conversations with their fire district about other things they could do within their urban renewal agency to help them. One thing you need to understand is that urban renewal agencies do not have the option of returning these revenues in a way that the money can be spent for operating costs. That is not an allowed use of urban renewal dollars. It must be used for capital expenditures and a very, you know, limited number of expenditures. So Kaiser's options were pretty limited when this was discovered. So I'd be happy to answer any other questions. And
you're essentially wearing two diametrically opposing hats today, aren't you? except that you all agree.
Thank you. Yes, that is correct. We do agree.
Thank you. Thank you. Anything else from this panel? Cindy, have you presented everybody who you wanted to present?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you.
You might hang around just to be sure we're covered. Cindy, we have a proposed amendment, the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3455. Apparently, there is an additional amendment which is needed that would have the effect, as I understand it, of applying large sub A, large sub B to the proposed amendment, but not large sub C. On page 2, lines 15 through 21 of the amendment. Does she have a copy of this amendment?
I do not.
Let's make sure that she does. So that you can look on it. What I think they're proposing is to further limit the application of this amendment by not having it apply to sub C of that subsection. And I'm not sure that we've actually accomplished that with the interlineation that they've added. And it may be that we need to hold the work session over for another day. We're in public hearing right now, but it may be that we need to hold the work session over for another day so that you can look at this and decide how to actually write the thing.
Yeah, Cindy Hunt, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel, Chair Barnhart. I actually am not the drafter of the original bill. She's out ill today. So this is actually the first time that I've been looking at the bill.
So I probably know more about it than you do.
Yes, you do.
Thank you.
That's a very fair statement. I think that, in the interest of doing it right, it may be a good idea for you to hold it over.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate that very much. We were hoping to hold a work session today, but I think that in the interest of getting a complex issue right, we'll hold it over and do the work session on another day when you can actually have when your office can actually have the amendment drafted correctly for us.
Yes, Chair Barnhart, yes. And if the drafter of this is still ill, that will give me a chance to take a look at the amendments in conjunction with the bill and make sure that they're correct.
And while Ms. Squires is listening, I want to make certain that we understand that it is their belief that the amendment that we're proposing by this bill should apply only to large sub A and large sub B, but not to large sub C. Is that the intent? I'm getting a head nod. That's what I think this means, but it isn't drafted correctly here.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on the public hearing on House Bill 3455? Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3455, and you've heard that we're not going to be able to work it today because the amendment isn't ready. We have one more item on our agenda, and that is the public hearing on House Bill 2592, and so we'll open that public hearing. Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2592 does a number of things with respect to the issues of tax compliance. It requires state income tax withholding from employer-sponsored retirement plans if federal taxes are withheld and applies to distributions made on or after January 1, 2008. It requires a 4% withholding on real estate transactions if the transfer is either a non-resident or an individual or not doing business in Oregon if a corporation. It also allows local governments that impose a local income tax to have the Department of Revenue collect the tax if the tax rate is no more than 1%. The tax is imposed if the rate is no more than 1%, if it's imposed on residents within the territory of the local government, and if the tax is imposed only on taxable income as defined for state purposes. It creates the Local Income Tax Collections Fund separate from the general fund, and interest earned by the fund is credited to the fund. It allows state agencies, boards, or commissions that issue occupational or professional licenses to require proof of compliance with Oregon's personal income or corporate excise and income taxes. It also allows them to suspend, revoke, or refuse to issue or renew a license if the licensee fails to demonstrate or maintain compliance. It also allows the Department of Revenue to adopt rules requiring payers of a specified type of payment to withhold up to 10% the amount that would be required to be withheld if the payment were wages. That's basically a kind of a blanket allowance for the for DOR to issue withholding rules. You also have in front of you a dash one amendment that simply removes two of those provisions, the withholding from employer-sponsored retirement plans and the 4% withholding on certain real estate transactions. The third item that that dash one amendment does is increase the percentage threshold for the local income tax from 1% to 3%.
Okay.
So it's kind of a potpourri of tax compliance tools.
Right. Thank you. Jody Weiser?
Jody Weiser with Tax Furnace, Oregon. I forgot to turn my stuff. I came prepared today only to talk about the real estate withholding section of this bill, although I have some good comment on other areas. We sat down and did some research because when this provision was in a piece of legislation last session, there was a lot of contention about it because the title companies weren't interested in doing the job that would be required by the real estate withholding. And so we did some looking to see what is happening in other states. And just by a couple of phone calls and using the web, we found that at least 15 states have withholding on sales by non-residents. The nearby states are Hawaii, Colorado, Idaho, and California. There are obviously a bunch of other states, and it's on there. They're on that sheet under item one. Like Oregon, Montana, and Arizona are also considering adding this legislation this year. And the reason is, as Dan Bucks, who's the Montana Director of Revenue, said, 97% of residents who make money from capital gains pay their taxes on time, but only 27% of those who live out of state do so. That's a huge difference in reporting. They did some research to find out, you know, what would happen, and they found that they had 1,021 non-resident sales of real estate in Montana in 2005, totaling $404 million. But over 70% of those taxpayers failed to file a report with Montana to pay their taxes. So they estimated that on that year alone, they would collect $5.5 million with this legislation. And that's the kind of statistics they're using to push for it in their state. There were some states that had only reporting, and all but one of those states has now chosen to move to withholding. I talked with Nellie Stevens, who is the one person who works at the Department of Revenue in Maryland handling this program. And she said they've brought in $15 million since October 2003. And they've found a couple of things. Not only are they finding people who have sold their apartment building or their rental real estate of other types, but they're and getting them for the capital gains, but they're also finding that they're asking to see their tax papers for the years of ownership, and many of them have not been paying taxes during the period of ownership of those buildings on their earnings. And so they're actually finding taxpayers in two ways, both the ones that were not reporting the sale of the property and the capital gains, but also that a number of those were not reporting their income all along to the state that they were supposed to be reporting it to. It seems to me that there's quite a bit of revenue available here. I had, in 2005, a piece of property that I sold in California, and the paperwork was about 5/8 of an inch thick. And there were two places in that stack of papers about the automatically withholding in California. One was about 2 inches on an information page. And the other was about as hard as filling out a W-4. You know, your name, your social security number, your address, and that sort of thing. And then they just automatically withhold. So it isn't a whole lot of work to do. In our search of the web, we only found one state that allows their department to assess an extra fee, and that's California. They allow an extra $45. In my own experience of doing real estate closings, the closing fees really don't seem to bear any relationship to the difficulty of the job anyway. I mean, if I've had ones where there were multiple owners and multiple sellers and, I mean, buyers, and there were complex financial arrangements, and I've had ones that were as simple as pie, and the fee just seems to be, you know, like we charge $275 for this service, and that's the way it is. The differences... There are differences in different programs. The people that I spoke to in the two states both said there needs to be a penalty in your law for not complying, that was a weakness in their laws, and that you need to think through where you want the payment made, because not every sale has a title company closing. Some of them are just done with the county clerk. So Maryland, for instance, has the county clerk collect the money rather than having the title company send the money in. So they kind of closed one of the loopholes. Both Colorado and Maryland said that they have had this experience now. Business people are setting up an LLC and transferring ownership of the property into an LLC that's got an address in their state, and then it doesn't get an automatic withholding because it's got a local address. So Maryland went back with new legislation to fix that. So I think that, one, I think this is a really powerful and important piece of legislation. It's not right for people to choose to not pay taxes because they're out of state. And two, we might want to work it, but what we have would work. We may come back with legislation in a later year saying we need to fix these loopholes that we found people using. And the other issue I think that you might address is whether you want to allow 1031 exchanges out of your state. Some states allow it and some states don't. Some states say you can do a 1031 exchange if you keep the money, if your next investment is in our state. But you can imagine that that you could sell a lot of apartment buildings in Oregon, buy a lot of apartment buildings in Washington State, and then Oregon would never collect the tax on that gain because you've done a 1031 exchange. And so some states have chosen to say, if you're exchanging out of our state, you pay taxes to us now.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you. Judy, as I understand it, the problem is out of state collecting from non-residents. If in your example, the Colorado said people would set up an in-state LLC, the problem goes away because it's visible. It becomes a state, an entity within the state. Am I wrong in that?
Well, what Colorado has said they were going to do is ask all the county departments to give them a data load of LLCs that had sold property so they could look to where the ownership of the LLCs was and see if find anybody that was using it. But it's true also that once you've got it on a 1099 for somebody that's located in your state, eventually you would get a take from the IRS that would give you some information. The out-of-state people, you don't ever get any notice because there's a 1099. It goes to the feds, but the feds only give Oregon the Oregon owners. And that's what these 15 states have found. The earliest state to enact this kind of legislation was 92. I think the most recent was 2005 that we found.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Butler.
Just a quick question. Jody, did any of these states report the chilling effect this might have on people that were trying to sell residences and leave the states as quickly as they could to avoid further intrusion into their personal tax issues?
Nobody mentioned that.
Okay. The thing I'm concerned about, Mr. Chair, is that when we talk about collecting a tax on somebody because they're selling a residence and leaving the state, that almost is punitive, particularly if the tax is based upon a gross amount, and we may not even be talking about that here.
Oh, Representative Butler, the situation, except for California, who they actually withhold from everybody. But the other states are just withholding on somebody who lives out of state. So it would be if a California person owns a bunch of properties at Sun River and they decide they're going to get rid of their five rentals at Sun River. And there would be no way, unless they voluntarily report, and Montana statistics say 70% of them wouldn't, that Oregon would know that they had sold that property.
Mr. Chair, my question was specific to personal residences. I have somebody that lives in Ontario, Oregon, and decides that they no longer want to live in Ontario. They move to Boise, Idaho. Their new address is Boise, Idaho. It's no longer Ontario, Oregon. So when the final closing 3 months later occurs, the problem is that they are now treated as Idaho residents because, in fact, they are. The concern that I've got is that, particularly with the real estate market slowing down, there may be people that have to look outside the state of Oregon for employment and may not be able to sell their residence in Oregon for some period of time. So that's why I express that concern with regard to personal residences.
But that they would have to have a pretty hefty gain, though, to have any due.
And Mr. Chair, that also then assumes that we're going to change the tax policy with regard to the taxation in Oregon on personal residences as well. So I don't know whether we go there or not.
I don't see how that does, because except in the example you give, Representative Butler, I think that the taxpayer would be, you know, we've got a $250,000 or $500,000 exemption for personal residences. And like what they do in Maryland is within 21 days of the closing, you can come to the Department of Revenue, to this woman, and give your documentation. And if you really only had 1% gain on the property, they will look at your records and say, okay, this is the amount that you have to pay. So you can come and present documentation that shows that you didn't have you're not going to owe 4% in taxes, if that were true. And the states have chosen from 2% to 9% as what's withheld. Usually it's their tax rate. The suggestion in our legislation is considerably less than our tax rate.
And I assume in that situation that actually could be done through closing.
Well, what they do in Maryland is that then the Maryland Department of Revenue would issue a document that they take to closing.
Right.
And so then the county clerk doesn't collect the full, I think it's 7% in their state.
So there's a variety of ways of doing that. Now, you're referring, are you, to Section 17?
I don't have the bill in front of me.
I think Section 17 is the general withholding. Real estate.
I think it's on page 3 of Sections 2, 3, and 4, basically.
Okay. Now, this amendment removes those sections.
Right. The amendment dash 1 does.
So you're opposed to the dash 1 amendment.
I haven't seen the dash 1
amendment. The dash 1 amendment removes page 1. 2, 3, the first six lines of page 4. So it removes sections 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5,
mm-hmm.
Which I think are the parts that you're talking about.
I'm talking about one section of that. Now, the retirement withholding, I've never heard anybody testify against that particular item. It was before us 2 years ago as well. And basically, as I understand it, there's just kind of some fluke in the law that says you get money withheld for federal purposes from your retirement annuity or whatever, but the state doesn't automatically withhold. With somebody in Representative McPherson's law practice that said, you know, this should be changed. It's silly.
Mm-hmm.
If the feds are withholding, why aren't we withholding?
Okay.
I really don't know more about that.
Yeah, thank you. Are there other questions for Jody? Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Does the department want to be heard today? No? Thank you. Any questions for the department? I think this bill has a ways to go yet, but we'll close the public hearing for now. And I say we're closing the public hearings. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard? There isn't. We're closed, and I think we're finished with our agenda for today. Are we?
Exhausted.
We are. The one bill that we did not hear, the amendments are not ready. And with that, we've exhausted our agenda again, and we are adjourned.